Katie.
I'm Erica.
And this is Book Talk.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, Erica.
Good morning. Welcome to Book Talk Podcast. This is our third episode about The Rabbit Hutch by Tess Gentry. Did I just make that up? Gunty. Oops. Katie, please remind us of all the million plot points that we're learning about in this section.
There are multiple stories happening here. So we start with Blandine's story. She goes with one of her roommates, Jack, to check out Max's apartment. Max is a real estate development guy who Blandine hates. She has a little sweet moment with Jack, a little bit of sexual tension building up here. We then go to Hope. She's the young mother we meet who's also living in the rabbit hutch, but we get to learn her pre-baby story the night the baby was conceived during the massive thousand-year flood. Her story with Anthony is so sweet. And then we flash forward again to this year, present day, and Moses, the one who's coming in to do the glow light situation, is staying in the same room a year later. He reads a weird letter from his followers from the quote-unquote mental health group that he manages, who's having visions of killing his wife. It freaks Moses out. He seems to be losing touch with reality a little bit in this section. Go back to Blandine in present day. She's trying to reach out a little, trying to form some connections, tries to hang out with her other roommate, Todd, to not a lot of success there. And then we spend a lot of time with Joan. Joan goes to find her friend Penny, who is unhoused, to bring her some of her gifts she no longer wants in her house. And Penny warns her about a creepy guy who's been sitting outside. She calls him Glacial. He just looks blank inside. The last scene is Blandine. She's in a park where she's going to read and kind of be by herself. She ends up finding a goat in the conservation area of the park who's injured and carries this baby goat to the road to be rescued by none other than James, of course.
Excellent summary.
Thank you so much.
What a way to end. Sorry to start at the end, but I was like, yeah. Oh no, here we go.
I know. I was like, of fucking course it's James. How extremely annoying that anyone on this road and it's James. Like, I feel like Blandine was just starting to maybe not be consistently obsessing about James. And then, of course, that's exactly when he comes back into the picture, which, like, I mean, fair. That is how life goes, but how annoying.
We also start this section with her finally maybe embracing a teenage romance or, you know, being interested in someone her own age, Jack, and the tenderness that they have and, like, the sexual charge. And she's sort of like, oh, maybe this could be what a relationship is like, that it feels good and maybe there's pleasure and maybe there's fun and excitement and maybe we have something. And then it ends with this sad, perverse predator that she's encountering. And now she's recognizing him as a predator. She said he looks like a wolf at the end.
Yeah, I feel like in the beginning, again, she's like kind of starting to heal. But I feel like it's always right when she's starting the healing process, you know, he's coming back into it. I wonder, I feel like she's trying so hard to connect with her roommates and they're all in love with her. And also Jack's not the one who's making her dinner and researching about her. So I just feel like that drama is going to be, is going to happen in some way because these three boys are just kind of fighting, except for Todd. He doesn't really give a shit. But the other two are like fighting for Blandine's attention and love. And so now that she's forming a connection with one of them, I wonder how that will play out in the last part of this book.
There's definitely an undercurrent of male threat. In this section, we have multiple men who are interacting in a very weird way with Blandine in the park scene. So you have the guys who catcall her, the person who almost hits her with the car and says it's like somehow her fault that he couldn't see her. And then I think it's Moses who's sleeping at the park wearing all black. And then James comes back. So it's there's this undercurrent of men staring at her, harassing her, objectifying her. And we also know the boys are doing this weird animal sacrificing. There's literally one page in one chapter where they're talking about how it's like escalating, this weird blood pact they have to like prove their love for her. It just makes me scared for her. I mean, we already know she's getting attacked and or murdered from the very beginning of this book, but it's like, you know, it's coming. And so it's building that fear. And also we now, at least I love Blandine, and I'm just so scared for what's coming.
And I think there are multiple other instances of vaguely threatening men, as you called them, throughout the book, not only to Blandine, but also to Joan. Like, I think that's probably Moses sitting in the car outside of her apartment. And it's like these things make everybody uneasy. But I was thinking about the part where Blandine's in the park. She's this guy sleeping. And she's like, I'm not going to be threatened by a sleeping man. I can fend for myself. I'm okay. But she's like recognizing the threat that poses to her while also being like, I think I can take it. And if that isn't like the epitome of existing in a world where you feel semi-anxious about men by themselves all the time, like, I don't know what is. But he wakes up and she tries to kind of, you know, distract him and like de-escalate the threat of the situation until she's like, okay, it's okay. But even when she's walking out, she's still like, is that him behind me? And I thought it was him behind her too.
I was not expecting it to be James. I thought it was either going to be him or it's going to be one of the other guys that were catcalling her when she was walking to the park there to like have their revenge on her. Or maybe it would have been one of her roommates who saw an opportunity for her alone. It's sad too, because they're in the park, which I think in this chapter, this last chapter, is the first time I really understand why Blandine loves the valley and wants to protect it. Because it seems like this beautiful, untouched paradise in the middle of crappy, cheap apartment buildings that have been thrown up all around. And this like facade of fakeness. Like, there's a lot too of this like Coke and the slushies and like the fast food gas station stuff. And I feel like that's just the aura of Vacca Vale. And then in the middle of it is this somehow untouched oasis where she can look at bees and clover and find random goats. And it just makes you, it makes it that much more painful that this place that has brought her so much peace is also where she's experiencing this sense of unease for the first time, even in her like little spot where she goes to, because it's always alone. Moses is there being threatening just by being himself. And I really wish that men who don't understand why catcalling or giving someone a compliment can be so threatening, to like read that part with Moses where he's leaving and he goes, you're really beautiful, by the way. And it's just like, I didn't ask for that. I wasn't looking for that. I would not like you to perceive me in that way at this time. She was literally like, here's some interesting facts that I've learned about a clover. Let me intellectualize myself to you. And then immediately as he leaves, it's like, by the way, I see you as a sexual object. Bye. Also, you should take that as a compliment.
I feel like Moses leaving was a little bit more tender and maybe reserved, because we know that he's kind of going through a lot. And obviously, like, there's no need to just be like, you're beautiful. But I think, and it probably does make her uncomfortable because she's already uncomfortable with him even after de-escalating it. But I think his seemed a little bit more like of an annoyance, whereas the catcalling is legitimately uncomfortable. They're catcalling her and then they're acting as if her mere existence in the world causes her to owe them something, to owe her, owe them accepting their compliments and letting them talk to her however they please. And at the end, she ends it. She's like, I know that there must be some reason they think catcalling is hilarious, but I don't know what it is. She's like, I don't get it. Why can't they just let me exist? So I think that part probably a lot of people can relate to as well.
That's definitely what I hear, at least when random people are like, hey, beautiful. Oh, nice eyes. Oh, the other day I was in the subway. Someone goes, take your mask off, beautiful, so they could like see the rest of my face.
Ew.
I know. Which, again, it's like something so simple as like, oh, wow, you're so beautiful. And it's like, I did not ask for you to look at me in that way or to engage with me. And I get that it's like a fine line, because sometimes you are social and you're out and you are trying to meet somebody and your channels are open and you're like, hello, compliment me. But being alone in a park is not the place where that's, and from these men who are significantly older than her, at least is what we're led to believe. She's like legitimately a child.
Correct. I think it is about reading the room. If you're with people and you're in a, like, if you're with people that you know and you're interacting with, you're conversing with them and they're like, oh, you look lovely tonight. Okay, great. But like, I feel like that fine line, I don't know why that's so hard to understand. When someone is walking by themselves or is in a situation where they're alone, like, it's not the time to compliment them. I also feel like this reminds me of like when men are walking alone on the street. And I remember, I don't know if I read about it or if it happened, I don't remember. But like, when they see a woman walking alone, will like cross the street, because like, I feel like you have to understand the just generalized perceived threat that you you know, are offering to this woman alone. And like, by being like, you're beautiful, I feel like I would immediately be on edge. Like, what risk does that put me at that that's how you're identifying the situation? Is that I'm beautiful? Okay, now I'm like even more, how do I protect myself in this situation? And I feel like the not understanding that is extremely frustrating. PSA to all men who do that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, honestly, if you wanted to talk to someone, just say, hi, how are you? What are you reading?
And also then, just like, don't talk to me alone in the park.
Or just don't talk to me when I'm alone in the park. Yes.
Correct. Just, like, absolutely not.
If I have headphones in and I'm reading my book, I don't want to discuss anything.
Oh my God. I was telling someone this the other day. I was on a plane and I'm sitting next to this person. I have my headphones in. I am an extremely anxious flyer. I have my headphones in. I'm leaning against the window. I'm reading a book. It's nighttime. I have the light on. This man is directly talking to me where I like, there's no, I'm against the window, so I can't like do anything. And he's just like talking. And I take my headphones out because I'm like, is something wrong? Like, why are you alerting me to this? Maybe I didn't hear an announcement or something. And he's like, oh, good. And then just like keeps talking to me, telling me about his job. And like, I don't even know what he was saying. And I was like, okay, and put my headphones back in. And like a minute later, he like taps me on the shoulder again. Sir, I have no desire to interact with you. What is going on? Ugh.
That's so awful. And I'm sorry, and funny. And yeah, just have like a little bit of other awareness. Like, just be aware of other people and the signals that they're sending you. But I also think some people have a face or an aura that says, I'm friendly and you can talk to me, and that's you. And other people have an aura that's like, I'm already judging you and I don't even know you, and that's me. And most people don't talk to me.
Everyone talks to me. They're like, do you want to hear? I'm like, nope, I actually don't. I know that I'm smiling, but it's just like a natural reaction in my face. It's not because I would like to continue this engagement.
Thank God for my resting bitch face, because people don't talk to me in a friendly way. I just get sexually harassed. But, you know, we cut out the middleman. You have to laugh so that you don't cry.
Literally. Ugh. Okay.
Our baby girl, Blandine. Again, it's such a character study in the way that she has been sexualized before she really understands her own sexuality and her own power and what she actually wants, because we get glimpses of that with her crush on her roommate, and even a little bit with Todd, where she's like, can I watch this with you? Can I sit next to you? Like, can we talk? And Todd's like, ew, no. We're not connecting. But then we have all these men who are taking advantage of or forcing sexuality upon her, I guess.
Yeah, there's something to be said for not being able to come into that on your own. And I think Blandine is a child, but even for that, your late teens, early 20s, like, there's so much of that being forced upon you before you even really know who you are. And it's kind of like the being forced to grow up part. And I think women especially, this is forced upon them to do it quicker, especially if you are friendly or flirty or you're developing young or whatever it is. I feel like it's just like it just gives permission to the rest of the world to move you into that phase in an unfair and way when you're just, you know, when you're still a child. Like, I do feel, I love Blandine in this section. I feel for her in this section. She's trying so hard to kind of overcome what she's been through and find this connection with people who are similar to her, or even people who are not. I mean, she's trying to connect with Joan, her roommates, anyone who will, and people are just not, except for Jack, really responding to that. But it is also the first time she's probably reached out to a lot of people. She seems like she was pretty closed off before this kind of new awakening in her.
Yeah, she's still, I think, sort of closed off. She seems very untethered in an unhealthy way. The other character who's very untethered in an unhealthy way is Moses, where he used to be sort of sympathetic, I think. And in this section, he has moved into not very sympathetic and controlling and abusive to his ex and scary.
There's so much going on in this book. We can get to that thought of that. I thought of that later. But yes, randomly we get this conversation where he's like berating his ex, who is falling into it, and she's, you know, answering him. It's terrible. Moses is like unhinged. I feel like he is not connected to reality. I also just out of nowhere, they're like, he runs this mental health blog for people who feel the same like anxiety or whatever it is that he's feeling. And then he's responding to fan mail as like a person who understands psychology or psychiatry, which he clearly does not, or at least is not currently in the real world with. So many subplots that are like well developed or thought out, like so much, there's so much detail packed into every single page of this book.
Do you like that or not like that? Do you find it challenging?
It is challenging for me. I think that the writing is beautiful, but it just seems a little bit disconnected from me for this book. I feel like it's almost like every single page is poetic and there's all of this detail, right? There's a lot going on, but it almost seems for me, again, too much to really be invested in these characters. Like, I want to be invested in Blandine, and we only got, you know, two chapters of her. And I feel like any one of these characters could be a full character study and story. And I love the way that she writes, but I just feel like, to me, it's just like a little bit too much of kind of the poetry for each of these individuals, because you're not spending that time in a character study of one person's head. You're in it across the board. And I think it's, for me, it's just a little bit too much. It's not, there's not enough plot pulling you through. And then I think the plot gets lost. And there's all these like random plot details, like this mental health blog just thrown in. It'll never be mentioned again. It's just thrown in, I guess, to give him context. But I'm not really sure if we needed that at this point in there. I mean, maybe we do, but I just feel like there's a ton of subplots, a ton of major plots, a ton of character study, and it just feels like a lot packed into this book. I don't dislike it. I think it's making it hard for me to connect with the overall story, even though I feel like a connection to Blandine. And when I read about Joan, I feel a connection to Joan, and I feel it throughout, but it's just nothing like pulling me through, I think. I'm just always constantly trying to process what happened in the last section of the book, instead of enjoying reading it and being able to kind of get lost in the head or the feelings of these characters.
I have been very positive about this book. When I was reading this third section, I was kind of getting over it. Like, okay, who cares about this email from this random guy who's hallucinating and Valentina and this whole story of playing Clue? I think the section totally rescued itself for me with this last chapter of Blandine going to the park. And we know that this kind of climactic event is very near. It's in a couple of hours. I think that really wrapped it up together. So I feel similarly to you. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of time spent with what seems like peripheral characters like Hope. It's not clear what Hope has to do with anything, but maybe Hope's going to come back in the end and save Blandine. Like, I think I have faith that Tess is going to wrap everything up, because we already see it. Like, the circles are collapsing in on themselves with Moses and Joan, Moses and Blandine, Blandine and her roommates and the real estate guys. Like, I'm just starting to see all of the connections and where everything is going and why we have each character. But it's not there yet. It's not tied together yet.
Right.
We'll see.
That's an ambitious goal for this last 25% of this book. And that's why I feel like I'm skeptical but excited. I think she could tie it together in a really amazing way where I'm like, wow, what a powerful story of all these people and how lives collide in ways that we don't understand when it's happening. So maybe I don't dislike it. I just think maybe we are doing a little bit too much of the kind of development of these side plots, but I don't know. Maybe they'll all come together. I enjoy reading every time I pick it up. I'm just not like, oh, I can't wait to get back into the heads of these characters like I am with some of the books that I really love. So I think it's fine.
I do really love Blandine. I also love I think once it's over, we'll look back and have a very clear narrative arc or story that Tess is trying to tell. I think it's maybe about human tenderness and human indifference and how cruel our indifference to each other is versus how powerful and transformative a little bit of tenderness can be. Because, you know, we have moments of like very sweet connection in this section, like for example between Hope and her husband, who genuinely love each other. And you know, even like Joan kind of talking about experiences in her life where she's seen how important tenderness is. And then we have all of this indifference. We even have indifference and tenderness in one couple, the couple outside of the gas station, where she's like, I don't want to do this anymore, and throws a seltzer water. But then he hugs her and he's like, we're going to get through this together. It's going to be okay. Like, clearly something else is going on. So I'm excited to finish. I can't wait to see what comes out. I'm trusting Tess that this is all going to come together. And I think this would be a book, because it's so rich, that the second time reading it, you'll maybe pull out why we spent time with each of these individual characters. But we can't see it right now.
I agree. I think that reading it a second time and taking a slower time about it, you could probably parse out all of these things about these people. I mean, it's really like three books inside of this one book. It is extremely rich. And like I said, I just think the writing maybe is a little too atmospheric, poetic constantly, that you kind of get a little numb to it. You're like, okay, every page is like this poetic, lovely writing, where maybe I would appreciate it more if I only got that when Blandine was at the lake or having this moment, not like constant at the gas station and at home, you know. So I think maybe that's it. I think Joan's section about human tenderness and the goodness that is in most people was very sweet. I loved reading about all of her kind of favorite memories that she's thinking back on, of the times that she had faith in humanity. And she was like, I love this species so much. Look at what they do for each other, how they care for each other. It reminds me of how when things are falling apart, everyone says, you know, look for the helpers. And I think it's like that same thing. Like, there is tenderness and goodness all around, but there's also the opposite of that constantly all around. And so how do you hold both of those things at the same time?
Very nice.
Okay, I'm going to believe you and trust in Tess.
All right, we'll see.
Here we go.
So next week we're finishing this book. The week after that, we have a special episode coming for you. And then the following week, we're going to start, finally, Our Wives Under the Sea by Julia Armfield.
I'm still so excited to read that book.
I can't wait. I finally was able to get a copy. So they are back up on Amazon, back up on bookshop.org, hopefully at your local bookstore. So get your copy of Our Wives Under the Sea, and we'll start reading that in a couple weeks. Talk. What are we reading?
Oh my God, this has been the roughest reading month of my life, and I'm blaming that fully on starting a new job. I am going on vacation next month, so I'm going to catch up my life and read a bunch of books on the beach. But for now, I am still just reading three books. I'm alternating between reading The Rabbit Hutch, reading Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, which I'm loving so far. I feel like reading Taylor Jenkins Reid compared to The Rabbit Hutch is a good, like, you know, they're very opposite. Taylor Jenkins Reid is like a ton of plot. It's like reading a movie. It's so interesting. And so I'm loving reading that kind of side by side with this one. And then I'm also reading Spare, Prince Harry's biography. Is it his biography or his memoir? His memoir with Jen and both of our moms. So we're reading 50 pages a week of Spare. And I mean, I love reading things about like the royals. So I'm here for it. So far, I'm like, Harry's a mediocre writer, but it's
if cute. He even wrote it, yeah.
I think he definitely wrote it, because it sounds like it's not great writing.
I watched part of their Netflix show, and I just find both of them like extremely out of touch and sort of annoying. And I'm like, I can't imagine writing this book. But I heard the book is actually even better. It's just more realistic, and he tells you like the funny stories and the not made for TV stories about like,
yeah, so yeah. Far it seems a little bit more raw. So I'm liking it so far. We're really at the beginning of it. I think when I watched that Harry and Meghan series, I could not stand them the first two or three episodes. By the end though, I was like, okay, I get it. I just feel like Meghan is so obnoxious in the beginning. I was like, this girl is extremely annoying. She's like, I've never heard of the royals. And I like curtsied. Have you ever curtsied? I'm like, okay, can you not? Extremely like disrespectful and annoying. But I think they got better by the end of it. So I would encourage you to watch the rest of it. I'll let you know how the book is.
Okay. I just can't get over the fact that her nickname for Harry is H. I'm like, that is not a nickname, Meghan. That's not a nickname.
That H? Is you trying to be like, look how intimate and close we are that I call him H. It's not like his first initial is J or like something like where it could be like an actual nickname. You don't say the word H constantly or like has. I'm like, what's happening? Call has him Harry.
I like has. I don't like H. That's
but has like his childhood nickname. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I'm going to send you a really funny TikTok about it.
Great. Okay. Can't wait. I am not reading a book that's different from The Rabbit Hutch, unfortunately. I'm reading The Candy House by Jennifer Egan. I love Jennifer Egan. She wrote A Visit from the Goon Squad, which I loved. But The Candy House is also, feels like a collection of short stories. Like every chapter is from a different character's perspective. And I'm genuinely getting the worlds confused between The Rabbit Hutch and The Candy House. And if you think there's a lot of characters in The Rabbit Hutch, oh my God, the amount of like families, acquaintances, roommates, childhood friends, sharing in a tragedy, married to someone else. It's like I need a diagram to figure out what's going on in The Candy House. And I had heard a little bit about the plot, and I thought it was going to be more techie, more Black Mirror. And there is that in the very background, but most of the book is these individual character studies. These, I just couldn't pick two worse books to read at the exact same time because they're so similar. But I don't know. The Candy House is good and not good at the same time. I'm not getting it at this point. And I can't keep everyone straight. Like, I just can't remember. They keep being like, oh, and then that's Chris. And I'm like, I should know who Chris is. Fuck. Who's Chris?
Yeah, reading two kind of big cast books at the same time is hard. Even reading Evelyn Hugo is hard because there's obviously her seven husbands and the kind of characters within there. And I started reading The Rabbit Hutch, and I was like, when I read the first like two sentences last night and I was picking it back up, I was like, wait, where are Evelyn and Donald, they're going? And then I was like, oh, wait, wrong book. Wrong people. Where am I at? Where is Blandine? It's like hard to go between two of them. So I can't imagine doing it with two big cast character study books at the same time.
At least in The Rabbit Hutch, Blandine having this like couple of days is a consistent, like you go back to it. In The Candy House, every single chapter is a different character in like a different timeline. So I may know Chris in sort of present day or what he's doing 20 years from now, but I just went backwards to when Chris was a teenager to meet a girl he met. And it's told from her perspective. And so you're like, wait, how? I can't connect to these two characters at all. Because it's not like, oh, now Blandine goes to the park and meets someone else. So it just feels much more disconnected. And maybe that's why I'm liking The Rabbit Hutch better. It actually feels very contained compared to The Candy House.
The Rabbit Hutch is a small world. And I appreciate that. I feel like you understand how they're connected. They all kind of live at this housing complex. I just think we're spending a lot of time in these innermost, like, deep thoughts with each of these characters, and so it's very interesting. It's a way of writing. I don't hate it,
but I'm going on vacation on Monday. So,
oh my god, on Monday?
I leave on Monday.
I'm so excited for you.
I can't wait. So maybe I will read a lot while I'm on vacation. Maybe I won't. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
No pressure. Just bring your Kindle in case you feel like you want to read. And if you don't want to read, then don't do it.
That's a good idea.
I do feel like there's always this pressure when you go on vacation, which I know that I just said, to be like, okay, I'm not doing anything. So I'm either going to A, be productive in a way that's not the same way I'm normally productive, but still productive instead of actually just resting. It's interesting. Like, I'm not going to work, but I am going to try to get ahead of my reading goal, which is the same thing. We're still being productive. It's like very annoying.
Yeah. The point of the trip is to hang out with Dan and go surfing. So reading is low on the list. But I will remember that with surfing, because you're right. I don't need to go and like clock in 40 hours on a surfboard just to feel productive.
Yeah. Right. And there's not like a goal at the end of it. It's to like enjoy surfing. Remember why you love it. And to find the joy in it. Not to be like, okay, did I get good enough at it? Was I as good as I was before? Did I do enough hours to be good by the end of the week? I mean, that's how I do when I do anything. It's extremely productive, and I'm like trying to stop doing that. Just enjoy being, but it's hard.
It's hard. Okay, well,
trying to meet a goal, baby.
All right, bye. See you in a more tan version of myself.
I love that for you.
Book Talk is made by me, Erica Bailey, and Katie Cheney, with production support from Dan White. Our theme music is by Dan White. We'll see you next week.